Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us. I remind you, Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA. And WEAA is provided in part by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at Bray and Scarf. And before we jump into our conversation, let's talk about this day in history, August the 8th, and what happened on this day in history. This is a day in history, one day I will not forget, in 1989. I always say that there are, I know many people in politics, I only have deep respect for a few. One of those men died in 1989, and that was Mickey Leland. Mickey Leland was a congressman from the Bay Area. He always stood up for the people's rights. He was a real warrior for social justice and economic justice. And he was killed in a plane crash in Ethiopia on that day in 1989 and was one of the shining lights of our political world. He died on this day. This is a day in 1968 at the Republican Convention in Miami that a riot broke out, a precursor to what was going to happen and take place later that month in Chicago that became very famous in the riots at the Baltimore's at the Democratic Convention. This is a day that these are all important for me to say because, as you did in the last week, you know how you have an umbrella and you need to put your umbrella someplace? You put it in something. It's a stand. You put it on. You put it in something and hold. Who invented that stand for an umbrella? A man named William C. Carter, an African-American inventor, created that in 1885 on this day. He got his patent. I think it's important, especially, I think every school day should start with young people in our schools learning about inventors who are African-American and what they brought to this world from little to small, from little to big. And so that's one thing that happened. This is also a day that on this day was born was Matthew Henson, African-American explorer, the first man to hit the North Pole. He was also, by the way, Matthew Henson, a teacher at Douglas Senior High School. He ran the science department at Douglas. People don't realize that Matthew Henson was one of the best faculty in Baltimore City Schools, some people argue, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, was at Douglas. And I wouldn't argue that point. I think that's probably true. This is the day in 1988 that Russians pulled out of Afghanistan after a nine-year war. We're still there. This is also the day, since we're still in baseball season, that the Baltimore Orioles pulled their 10th triple play against Oakland. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Not that I'm, a sports fanatic, but I thought I'd share that anyway. Anything else here I wanted to give you on this day in history? I think we'll stop there. Oh, we should have his music queued up. We talked about this yesterday and we didn't do it. Maybe Bobby can find some. This is, on this day in 1995, Jerry Garcia died. The Grateful Dead. One of the seminal groups in American rock and roll. Changed the nature of rock and roll. And on this day in 1995, he passed. So we'll leave it there and turn to our conversation here in the studio. So as I said, a couple months back, Keith Snipes, who's a friend, takes over the show every once in a while when I'm not in the seat. He's an actor, narrator, writer, social commentator. Said, Mark, we should do a show about black men in the arts. So we did a piece together. And in the course of that program, Keith can describe this in a few minutes, he used the phrase deep voices. So when I got home that evening, Valerie said, that's my wife, said to me, that you should do the series and call it Deep Voices and just delve into what that means. So Keith is back with us. Coley Tengela is here. Coley is a 2010 Open Society Institute Fellow, Executive Director of Kulichik. Say it, man.
Kulichikaga.
Project. And he's a paraeducator and facilitator of the Learning for Performing Arts program at Collington Square. That now he's going to a new school.
Yeah, the incredible Augusta Feld Savage, West Side of Baltimore.
And wrote and produced
West Side?
Wrote from east to west. Not everybody can do that. Wrote and produced in collaboration with his students. We got this. Be inspired and be more, which is a program around. An old friend, Jerry Prettyman. A lifetime artist, studied applied art and design at Catonsville Community College, Maryland Institute of Art, and find out here at Morgan State University, one of the great artists in our community. Bashi Rose is with us.
Hey.
Bashi, always good to have him here. Established the Direct Response Alleviate Misdirected Aggression Program, DRAMA, which gives black male high school kids and incarcerated adults an opportunity to use theater. He's a filmmaker, co-founder of Menonomo Theater. He's got a new film he's working on now. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
As your partner in crime told me.
That's good.
And David Son Ross. David Ross has been on the show before. He's a poet, member of the spoken word duo The Fifth L. His newest solo CD is called In Late Bloom. David, good to have you back in
Thank
the
you
house
for
as well.
Having me.
Everybody, join us here, 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. So let's jump off just even to this idea of deep voices for a moment. Let's talk about that. And Keith, about the derivation of that, and talk a bit about that and what you meant when you first said it here on the show.
Mark, this, the idea of having black men come together and talk about the importance of the arts, not just to the men in this room, black men in our sort of diverse age group. I think David's probably not in this generation, but he's the only one in here that I'm not seeing gray on. Bashi
is
a little, but
enough.
You know, but you know, I think that art is significant to all of humanity, but I think it's particularly significant to those who find themselves in spaces of disenfranchisement, spaces where there is not much opportunity to express oneself. And I think that black males fit into that category. And art is one of those spaces that is, to some extent, uncensored. It doesn't require diplomacy. You can tell truth. But the idea of deep voice came from, as I told you before, a story where I heard James Earl Jones being interviewed, and the interviewer asked him if he's in love with his voice. And his response was, no, I hardly ever hear my voice. And then he said, but when I do, I hear it as a tool. I hear it as a tool. But he went on to say, but I understand that the baritone voice is a gift. And when one is given that gift, they have an obligation to provide clarity. So what I took that to mean was the baritone voice being deep and clarity being speaking up. I took that to mean that those who have deep voices have an obligation to speak up. Black men, no matter what the tonation of the voice, whether you sound like James Earl Jones or Pee Wee Herman, you have an existentially deep voice. So that was the impetus for this idea of deep voices.
And one of the things I thought about in hearing that, and Jerry, I mean, I'm glad you got to me saying you really want to be part of this discussion because I respect your art and your mind a great deal. When I was listening to when I thought about this deep voices idea, one of the things that struck me was that the deep voice, as you were just alluding to, is something that is beyond tonality. It's about a social experience, about a life experience, about existence in this country and existence on this planet, and the depth of what the introspection of an artist can bring out to share with the rest of the world. Jerry, you want to jump in?
Right, I agree. I concur with everything what Keith just said, and I'd like listening to Keith, to be honest with you. He talks, but he has substance. He's not just running off at the mouth and babbling and so forth. There's always substance, and I always learn from Keith. And I'm glad to be looking at you now and telling you that.
Thank you, brother. I
learned
appreciate
a lot from
that.
You, brother.
I appreciate that.
And I don't have those skills, and I kind of use my art as my voice. And I've gotten in some troubles with that art. In the early days, I used to kind of was interested in making political statements, statements about things that I felt. And people honestly didn't want to see it. And I think there's a disconnect in our community where art, most people are not really familiar with art. They don't know, you know, it's just something to stick on the wall or over in the corner, over the chair, over the sofa, that kind of thing. So there's no real connection between the artist and the community in many instances. So I began to tone my work down a bit, and the reality of trying to make it as an artist, it's like any other business. You have to, in my opinion, you have to gear your art in most instances towards what galleries are looking for, to survive. As an example, I used to work for a gallery called Gallery G. It used to be in Westview Mall. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Years ago. And I used to do people's cats and dogs and babies and, you know, 50-year-old women that wanted to look 18. You know? And I got beat up a lot on that one. But I did it for about 5 or 6 years, and I didn't enjoy it, but it was a way of trying to keep income coming in and using your art to make money. And unfortunately, in my training, I never really learned how to market art as a business. And I had to learn from life experiences how to survive as an artist. And so now, at this point in my life now, I'm 65. I'll be 66 shortly. And
will that happen while you're sitting here?
No. No. All my I'm the young one in all my peer groups. I'm the young one. My birthday's in December. You know. But now at this point now, I'm at a point where I can kind of put a lot of life experiences into the work. And the work has been very well received. Very well received, I have to say. I think in our culture, good art as it relates to money and how much recognition you get and that kind of thing, kind of determines what good art is or what good artists are, mm-hmm, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily true. But in terms of my voice, I am able to do some things and say some things now that I'm not concerned about sales necessarily or directing it to any particular venue. And I guess cross-culturally, most of my work has been original works have been sold, bought by whites. They seem to have an attraction to it. It's a lot of jazz. I do a lot of jazz imagery and a lot of with African influences and political statements kind of put in the art now. And so, to a large extent, that the work has become universal. In my opinion, a lot of interest that seems to be kind of cross-cultural interest in the work.
Anybody, just leap in. As we get this one, Khalil here, about to jump in anyway.
I would like to add on to that. I think one of the issues that we as African men, black men, whatever descriptive term you would like to use, I think we need to look at it two ways. We're in a dominant white European cultural valued situation. And I think a lot of times all people of color, but in particularly African folk within that context, we have and been trained, indoctrinated to believe we have to have acceptance of the white dominant culture. We believe that what we create is not valid unless it's validated by that dominant cultural strain. We associate money from the dominant culture, which may happen to be white, is the only legitimate money that we can get. We are professional when white dominant culture accepts us. And I used to be a part of that till several years ago, till I realized we as African folk, we spend a lot of money on very toxic, unhealthy pathologies and things, from hot sauce to shiny jewelry to other people's hair, manufactured and real, that we place on our bodies, that we value and that we do. I think if we as artists, coming from an African cosmological point of view, where art is used as a healing tool to empower instead of as an entertainment for entertainment's sake, and use it as a healing tool to heal the pain and trauma that we've experienced, to teach us to love and appreciate ourselves, that there's enormous financial resources that we can get from our own community and from our own people. I think that dynamic of wanting other individuals to embrace and like what we do is really unhealthy and is a part of the psychological trauma and pain that people of color and people who are marginalized have to do. Oh, yes, let the dominant cultural individual validate me with something by purchasing what I do or writing a positive review. I think we need to look at how we can use our tools to heal ourselves, to love ourselves, to purge ourselves of the toxic and unhealthy pathologies, and then we won't have to seek that validation. I think we need to embrace and love ourselves and stop seeking that. And I think the artwork will stand on its own. And whether it's appreciated or not, we need to appreciate it and stop tailoring what we do to please our own people. But then again, more often than not, to get the dominant culture to embrace us. I think that's very unhealthy.
So I mean, let's pick up on these points here. This is important. I'm going to have some questions with this in a minute, but I just want to hear everybody's voice jump out. David.
Well, I think, it's interesting when you talk about validation. I think it probably even goes a step further than that. When my brother here was saying, that most of the people who buy his art, they're white, and a lot of times, even for myself, that's the audience that's purchasing the work, not only purchasing it, but carrying it even further. I think because there are so many talented black people, at least in my arts community, like we don't support each other enough, even those who aren't artists, just people just come out to show patron. I think that it's just not enough. When you think about all of the different art forms, music, jazz, and stuff, like the people that I know that are listening to it and playing it now, they're not African American, and the people, the musicians, that's their audience, that's the people who will come out to see it. So I think the validation comes from you're thinking in your head, like, well, who's going to, buy this?
But there's reasons for that. There's reasons why African people have a disdain, dislike, don't want to patronize, don't want to purchase things that resemble them and are healthy images. There are legitimate psychological reasons. And hopefully there's some clinician listening that could call in with their degree from whether it's a white institution, but hopefully a predominantly African-American institution like Morgan State University. We'll call in and say there's reasons why individuals are repulsed by things that are healthy of themselves when you have been indoctrinated and told that you are ugly. That's why the audiences, we will embrace unhealthy Rick Ross and 2 Chainz rappers and be repulsed by jazz and blues and even neo-soul that uplifts African folk in a way. There are legitimate psychological reasons why we hate ourselves. And I think we should look at it more therapeutically.
Yeah, I mean, I hear the conversation revolving a lot around the commerce of art, but for the most part, I've been more interested in using art to engage folk who usually don't have access to it. I think art, I see art as a tool, for us to tap into the history of resistance and rebellion of our people in this nation, and globally, when you look at the whole African diaspora. So for me, I see art more, as a tool for rebellion, as a tool for introspection, as a tool for healing, as one of the brothers mentioned. And I think that's, for me, that's the conversation I'm more interested in. How we make our paper doing our art, that's a whole nother topic, But for me, in a city where we make up less than 30% of the population of the state, people of African descent, but we make up over 70% of the prison population in Maryland. So, since 2007, being able to work with a lot of our brothers who were locked down and, using theater as a tool for them to have discussions, with different with men who are different ages, who have different ideologies, different religious opinions, and being able to even use theater as a tool to critique the prison industrial complex right in front of the administrators there. And I see art, as a weapon. And when I was in L.A. not too long ago for a conference, an older Hispanic brother pulled me up, and he referred to, folk like us as cultural warriors, and the importance of contributing to that collective consciousness that precedes social change and rebellion and revolution, if you will. Because for me, at the end of the day, that's what's needed.
Before we go to Keith, our first caller up. So hold on, Keith. We're going to come to you. I do want to raise some things because several different layers came out in the last few minutes of you all positing what you thought. Let me kind of parse something out. Let me take just one, which is in some ways the most obvious, but then come back to what everybody was saying on some other deeper levels as well. When you look at art and let's say black arts interaction with the larger white world in America, just starting there. I think what Jerry was saying, what everybody else was saying after what Jerry said, part of it maybe is when, you know, Mark Kottman on the show said that, was talking about how he's now learned in teaching others how to market their art. It was another painter in his, you know, around our age, Jerry and my age. But that medium itself, is it the fact that wealth is centered, for the most part, in the white world and historic wealth coming out of the white world, that things like paintings, that kind of physical artwork, sculptures, paintings, and other things like that, are a more easily purchased by folks in the white world than, because artists put a lot of work into a physical piece of art that they create, whatever that art is, and they want to be remunerated for the time it took to put into that art. That's part of the price of the art, like the art that hangs out here in the hallways of WEAA. And there's that, and also there's the whole commercial side where most of the jazz, and maybe it's just demographics, but most of the jazz, most of the rap, most of the blues in America are purchased in the white world. You know, so I mean, there's that, the commercial side. The other things you also want to really get to, but since that came up first, let's wrestle with that for a minute.
I think part of that, Mark, is obviously a function of numbers. You know, we live in a country where we are a mere 12% of the population, so whites are going to buy more. But I think that the other part of that is that a consequence of capitalism is that there is not much time for luxury, and art is perceived by most Americans as a luxury, as opposed to a necessity, something that you do in your spare time, something that you partake of in your spare time. So I think that's part of the problem. In the black community, luxury gets less time because a function of capitalism is to keep the black community under stress, where survival becomes the primary focus. So I think that what the artist can do is speak to issues like that to sort of enliven that part of our humanity that says, I need art. I do think that art is a function of humanity. You look at the universe is an artist. You know, we come out of our houses every day and we see beautiful things that have been created as a function of nature. And so art is not only a vocation, it is a natural phenomenon. And until we connect with that natural phenomenon and see it for the bigness that it really is, we will continue to look at it through a commercial lens.
We have to get a very brief break. We'll come right back and we'll come back to this. Now, then I want to also kind of get to the phones. People are calling in. And I want to raise the issue of dominant culture's art interaction and the role that the African world in America plays in defining the art of America, unseen and now seen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Stein, and welcome back to Deep Voices, a show created out of the mind of Keith Snipes, one of our guests and the constant co-host here on the Mark Steiner Show. Coley Tengela, actor, teacher in our community. Jerry Prettyman, artist, been an artist for a very long time. Bashi Rose, a theater man, teacher, writer, filmmaker. And David Ross, native son, spoken word artist. 410-319-8888. I want to get to the phones here, but very quickly, this kind of, if anyone wants to contribute to that last question, please do. But
I just want to say, he mentioned capitalism and the effect that it has on on people of African descent of this country, you know, economically, socially, politically, and the role of art. So what are we talking about? Are we talking about creating a class of privileged black artists who can sell their art? Or are we talking about using art to dismantle capitalism that has us in the position that we're in?
That's a very good point. That's another show topic for a whole hour, but we can get into that as well today.
Again, I would like to add, we have to look at the dynamic that we as African people have tremendous economic power, and because of distorted view of ourselves that's unhealthy, that we prefer to spend our money elsewhere. I think once we begin to use our art to change that, and it's difficult. It's difficult for me to deal with my own demons. It's also difficult to deal with another brother and sister dealing with their demons, where they're repulsed by the images and the films that I do with young people and adults and the stage productions that I do with young people. But one thing I do after each and every production is have clinicians available after the screenings and the performances, that if you are experiencing any of the issues depicted in the film or in the production, they are here. Let's see if your insurance, social assistance will be there to assist you in dealing with it. I believe we should use our art, whether it's visually, whether it's through spoken word, whether it's through narration, and also Keith Snipes is a great writer, Bashi and his incredible work, to use it as an actual tool to entertainingly educate individuals to love themselves. Because we as Africans spend billions of dollars, but also we have billions and billions of pain and trauma multiplied by decades that we have to deal with so that we can unleash our economic power to embrace ourselves. And I think that we need to broach instead of looking at it from the dominant template from which we're in. Because there's other ethnic groups that singly market poor, marginalized black people and make millions of dollars in our community each and every day. Why can't we as African people, irregardless of what genre we decide to work in, why can't we market our own people to clinching at wealth? But we have to decide what is the issue that prevents us who look like one another from dealing, doing business, and loving one another.
Let me hit the phones here, 410-319-8888, and come back to the panel. Keith, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Keith.
My question is to some of the people on your panel, and I don't really take issue with it. I think the humanities for most African American, especially the children, is great. And like you say, you know, if I had money or extra money out of my check or something like that to invest in African American art, or just the humanities in general, I would. But my question is this: I'll give you an example. I went to Artscape this year. I ran into one African-American artist who paints. He was from Greensboro, North Carolina. I mean, I'm not saying that. Is there a concerted effort to get into these mainstream festivals and things like that? I mean, you know, I have young children, and I would love for them to be able to. I don't really know a lot about art, black art. And, you know, any kind of workshops that are given around the city, anything like that? I mean, maybe free workshops where they can be introduced to art. That's my question. You guys have a nice day.
That's a really good question.
I think Artscape, and I performed in Artscape this year, and I don't know too many people that I know who saw my performance. And I think that there's something to be said about that. We had essentially a packed house, and the Lyric holds about 2,000 people. I don't know too many black folk in Baltimore who saw my performance, but I believe that Artscape is one of those festivals that is planned and executed in a very almost clandestine way, where, you know, there's no feelers put out to artists in the community.
Okay, that's true. That's
that
true.
That where they say, hey, we want to be representative of not just Baltimore, but of the diversity in arts. So submit something and let us consider it. That doesn't happen. So it's incumbent on us as artists to push back on that.
David, you're going to say what?
Yeah, I think that all of these things pretty much go hand in hand, you know, in order. And just to respond to the caller, I mean, there are tons of things going on in Baltimore City alone almost every night of the week, you know, from, artists who do give workshops. They do performances. They're all types of not just open mics, but shows, you know, that people people are giving. Bashi has a show that you're doing right now, right?
No, Robert Lee Hardy.
Robert Lee Hardy's doing it.
Yeah. A real nigga show.
Yeah.
It's right. Friday and Saturday at Theater Project.
Theater Project. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and Theater Project, Center Stage, even, I mean, there's shows going on just about every night of the week, you know, and I guess they're not getting the light that they could to expose people.
Maybe one of the things here, maybe there's a responsibility here, maybe throw this out since we're sitting here at WEAA. Maybe there's a responsibility here at WEAA as well to promote those the arts. I mean, we do our best as we can on this show to promote the arts all the time to get that out there. But, you know, like we had the sisters on yesterday to have a with the performance, the poets, the performance is Sunday night here in Baltimore. And you're right, stuff does happen every night. It happens in venues that are owned with African artists. That are predominantly white institutions and also institutions that are owned by black folks in town. It's happening every night. But I think people don't know about it, and they're accessible.
I just want to give the call some specific locations. You have the Twigs program. They have a visual arts program for youth, and that could actually help prepare them to maybe get into the Baltimore School of the Arts. You have a youth arts program at Creative Alliance as well. So those are two contacts for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those are wonderful programs, but those are predominantly white institutions that have their own agenda. They do wonderful work, the Twigs program and the Creative Alliance, wonderful organizations. But there's also the UB Blake Cultural Center. There's also the Arena Players. And also, Keith was sharing, there is maybe some substitute sometimes in where organizations like Artscape are organized. There's not much advertising outreach in Cherry Hill for Artscape or Lower Park Heights. I think it's the stereotypical fear if you get a group of African American people coming into Artscape, which is solely marketed for art and from a particular point of view, predominantly white, that there's going to be some kind of issue and conflict. But yet and still, most of the major musical acts that they choose are pop cultural, R&B, hip-hop individuals that is the draw. But I guess they're looking at a certain kind of African-American person. I think if we stop viewing by color and class racism, and saying that folk from Lower Park Heights, where I was born and raised, Cherry Hill, Pennsylvania Avenue, Sandtown, east side of Baltimore, where I've taught for 7 years, and say, how can we truly embrace folk who are marginalized and challenged and make them feel fully a part of our city? It's a delicate dance that we have to do. But also in terms of artists, you know, a lot of time artists, we are horrible marketers of our stuff. Mm-hmm. We get wrapped up in the creation of it. We'll make our CD, make our film, make our book, and just look at us. Isn't it beautiful? Ooh, look at it. I got a barcode. Ooh, look at my graphics. But instead of grinding out and promoting it to make sure it translates into cash, I go back to my premise. The reason why African folk from a certain class, from and even not even class, economic class, because there's a middle class and upper class and affluent African-American folk who have internalized self-hatred, too, that don't like themselves. But I think we should deal with that. And I think we should use art as a tool for that.
That's true. But look at this room. And look at the people who populate a lot of the programs on the station. This is people who are not kind of going through self-inflicted wounds, we all do. Your art is changing yourselves, and your art's changing the community that touches your art, and your art is changing the world beyond the black world when your art touches them. When people see the stuff you do, the theater and film pieces you do, I've watched the audience reactions to your work. You know, and you could, and your audiences are usually very racially mixed some of the venues you go to, but you see. I mean, people have to wrestle with what's being given them, and that's a part of what I want to ask. And in the next level of this is, you know, and I want to come back to maybe kind of wrestling with all these questions we've raised here, as whole hour discussions in just one topic. But they're throwing it out that the power of the African American artistic world, even though the finances and the ownership is predominantly not in the African-American world, has altered America. I mean, there's people, that's part that people don't wrestle with and want to wrestle with all the time. There would be no United States of America if there weren't African Americans in the United States of America.
That's right. That's right. And I think that with if you look at art from the prism of entertainment, it almost makes it look like there are 300 million black people in America. Art tends to be ubiquitous. It tends to give us more in numbers than there really are. There are probably whites in this country who think that we constitute 35 to 40% of the population, which is why there's so much fear. But the reality is that the art that you're talking about is that that is being marketed is art as entertainment. What I'm trying to get at as art as a possibility for change, art as a human functionality that gives people a different way of looking at things. One of the things that I believe as black men we certainly need to explore is how does art allow us to express variations on masculinity? Because one of the most destructive forces in America is masculinity, and certainly one of the most destructive forces or our expressions, I should not say masculinity itself, but the way that we express masculinity in this country is destructive. That becomes multiplied in a community where people, as Coley said, where folk are constantly looking for validation. So those notions of masculinity become on steroids. They become amplified, the bravado, the machismo, all of those things. So I think art allows for us to create different ways of expressing masculinity from an aspirational masculinity that is based solely on competition to an inspirational masculinity that is based on cooperation.
Let me get
go ahead.
Abashi,
yeah.
David, Jerry, please jump in here.
As far as us not profiting from our own art, it's interesting. You know, being a theater artist, I tend to look at stuff theater perspective. And it reminds me of the African Grove Theater back in 1821 up in New York.
Ira Aldridge.
Ira Aldridge came through. And so you had this black theater during this time. Slavery still, you know, obviously present in the country. And it was actually thriving. They were doing Shakespeare, doing original, African slave rebellion plays, what have you. And there was a theater right down the street that basically made a lot of their money doing blackface. So when they saw all these patrons coming to the African Grove Theater, you know what I'm saying, they got pissed off and actually ended up, you know what I'm saying, engaging in a white riot of the African Grove Theater and actually burnt, you know, the African Grove Theater to the ground.
Right.
And to me, in a sense, that still goes on to this day. Not only you know, did they get several centuries of free labor, now they're profiting from our culture. You know what I'm saying? And the only way that's going to change is if we change it aggressively.
I think in order to do that also, you know, sometimes we look at money as being evil or a sinful thing, you know, to have or to say you want to do. But, you know, you need funding, you know, to make the progress in these things. I mean, there's this new arts district down on North Avenue, and any one of us should have a building there, you know, to ownership, you know, or to be a part of some type of grant, you know, to fund it. We need to fund it. We need to be replenished so that we can do these things and so that we can grow. A lot of the kids, you know, that, you know, we go to the schools to see or we go into the prisons to see, the thing that they respect, which a lot of people do in this country, is money, because money talks. So when they're seeing a drug dealer in their neighborhood, and that's who they want to be like, or they're seeing their favorite football star, or they're seeing a musician that they enjoy and that they want to be like, and they're all raising their hands, what you want to be when you grow up, a football player, or, you know, a rapper or whatever. It's because that's what they're saying as success. So I think that it would be really interesting to see if, you know, African-American doctors, artists, whoever, move to these neighborhoods, kind of like I guess, a residency, you know, to stay so that these kids can see something different. I don't think that it's really that they want to be involved in negative lifestyles, but that's what they're being taught, you know, because they feel like that's what's going to get them to the place where they want to be, showing them other forms of success. But the only way you can do that, it's hard to do that being a community activist or an artist and you're still broke, you know?
I think you
Go ahead, Bashi. I want to go to the phones right after this.
No, I think by them seeing us coming in there, they also see us as an example, as an alternative, you know what I'm saying, to the hustlers that they usually
That's
see.
Right.
And a lot of times when they talk to me, they're like, what? You've been here, you've been there, you're doing that? What? I didn't even know, you know what I'm saying? I could live that type of lifestyle, you know what I'm saying? And I think part of it is helping to develop that sense of consciousness, to know, teach them the craft of the art, mm-hmm. how to make a living, but also that you also it's your responsibility to use this art to challenge and dismantle those things that are keeping our communities in a situation. And that's why they can build a Station North Arts District without us raising hell, without us demanding that we have a building. You know, say we're not going to get any of these things unless we're in their face and we're demanding it and taking it.
Art is weapon.
That's what they're doing.
Let me get the phone shared. And we're doing a whole series on Station North Arts, and we'll continue following it because that's part of the issue of Station North Arts is this is an opportunity where the white and black artistic world can meet at this corner of
Absolutely.
North and Charles, mm-hmm. and that has to happen.
Yep.
And that's what has to be pushed because it's absurd to think you're going to build this district in a mostly black neighborhood and that black folks are not going to be part of the main part of the Station North Arts. That makes no bloody sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's insane. This and some other things right now are a unique opportunity to push the point, to make that voice heard. It has to be heard now. It can't allow it to be happening any other way. If single Kara can have a theater there, you should have a theater there. You know? 410-319-8888. William, you're on the air. I'm sorry.
Good morning to you and your guests. I was in Delaware, and I picked up a book called The Short History of African Art by Warner Gilliam. And I'm reading through it, and there's a lot of art in, like the National Museum in Denmark has a lot of art. And also the National Commission of Museums and Monuments in Lagos, Nigeria, they have a tremendous, I mean, you used to see these pictures. It's just, the book is almost all pictures of statues and carvings and, you know, some is ironwork, some is copperwork, some are wood, and it's in Penguin Books. So I would suggest maybe take a look at something like that. It's the Yoruba people and also the Akan Ashanti people. It shows their carvings and you know and a lot of their expressions. And I think from my standpoint, art is a visual element. I mean, you have to see it to appreciate it, and if you don't see it, you have no idea what it is, you know, unless you see it. So I think, because I'm speaking for myself as a child, my grandfather was a master carpenter, and he did a lot of woodwork and stuff, and that's how I became a carpenter, you know, and I start, my art is carpentry, so I put my art into a three-dimensional kind of practical
right.
Appreciation. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I would suggest, looking at some of the books, I have the children read some of those books, like Penguin Books, the Short History of African Art, and that would kind of give them a connection. You say, wow, that person looks like my aunt so-and-so, the face, you know, the features. That's how you get an identification.
It's an important little book. I mean, I have that book sitting on my shelf. It's really important. If you don't know the book, you should have it. Jerry, did you want to jump in? And then, Coley, I'm going to go back to the
phone. Yeah, I just want to comment.
We don't have like 10 minutes left when we get to our callers.
I just want to comment on that piece about the Arts District. And I was one of the original artists in that Load of Fun building. There was
On North Avenue.
On North Avenue. And there was initially, I think, two of us in there. And, of course, the owner of the building was white. And I believe he was South African. And we had some serious conversations, and it's—I don't know if I should share those conversations, but it was pretty eye-opening. And a lot of the conversations kind of dealt with being in the black area, where the Koreans own a lot of property in that area. And you know, Micah had a building across the street. And, basically, we were kind of outsiders in our own neighborhood, so to speak, and. I guess I'm one of these people. It'd be nice to have grants or whatever you can get to raise money to do what you feel like you need to do. And I think that's where we're lacking. We don't seem to have the wherewithal, for whatever reason, to, you know, if we want a building, let's get a building. We don't need to run the city hall necessarily. We do, but we don't necessarily need to run the city hall. But just have the strength and the wherewithal to pull our own stuff mm-hmm. together and mm-hmm. do what we need to do. We don't need verification. We don't need validation. We don't need to run here. We don't need to run there. Just do what we need to do. And that's one of the things that's kind of, you know, it bothers me where we're constantly kind of behind an eight ball that we don't seem to be able to get around.
Well, I mean, one of the things about North is one particularly Arts District. Station North Arts, yeah. which you made me think of just now, and Coley, come right to you next, is that maybe we should, maybe, I mean, the reality is that most of those buildings in that area are owned by one of the foundations, they're owned by other folks with means and
Owned by folks other than black folks.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So maybe what has to happen on some levels, given that district, is that the issue has to be forced, and people's minds around racial justice have to be changed or pushed to change so that the space is shared. That's just reality. I mean, it has to be.
But let me tell you this. Like, right up the street from there, it used to be called Odell's.
Right.
They opened up the Heritage Theater there, you know, and it stayed open, I don't even know if it was 2 years. But it wasn't supported, you know. Olu Butterfly, a phenomenal poet in the city.
Yeah.
She tried to do events there to get people coming there. Mm-hmm. And right in the neighborhood, you know, and could not get people to come out and support, you know, and I think they were black men that owned that building at that time, you know. So on the business end, I mean, I don't know how good they were at keeping things up or if it was solely just about getting people to come in, but it's a shame how that just went down.
But when it was Odell's, it was supported.
Well, yes, and we know why.
You knew if you belonged. You belong with art.
And people like to dance. They went to Odell's.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to reference a couple of points, but I want to get back to Brother Snipes' point about masculinity in terms of the expression of art. I think it's important that we as artists, as Brother Bashi was also mentioning too, to dismantle and develop a new construct of what masculinity is. Masculinity is not about always the way it's expressed now, not only among African people in America, but all men in America and boys through a hyper-aggressive, violent-like behavior. Masculinity, we have to change it to mean embracing and loving your children. Being a hardcore man it should be the image of an African man or any man holding and embracing their child, of a man preparing a meal for his family or his spouse or partner. That should be a new dynamic of what true masculinity is. And we as artists can change that. And also, too, what I've been concerned about is African men, black men, wherever we are on the planet, stop learning to deal with our pain, to truly embrace one another, and stop viewing another African man or boy as a competitor, as an aggressor, as an adversary, and to embrace ourselves. And then we have to deal with another dynamic, which is a whole nother story, is dealing with brothers and also sisters who are gay and lesbian, because that falls into the masculine expression as well. And can a heterosexual masculine brother sit down with a gay, maybe effeminate or non-effeminate person, brother, and work jointly for a common cause of empowering other African people? These are the deep-seated issues that we go through. And I think trying to piece through that pain and to determine why that theater didn't work, and analyzing why, but then also go after specifically our own people in a loving way, knowing our pain and trauma, to get them to embrace what you do. It's more than a notion, but I've been able to do it. In my next film that I'm just finishing up now called Here For You, I'm dealing with bullying, but I also wanted to show images of African men. So I actually got fathers of the student actors to portray the fathers of their children in the film, in a loving way, being supportive of their children instead of going out to African-American mothers and women, showing fathers sitting down nurturingly talking about the pain their children go through and lovingly encouraging them. I think that is what we can do.
I just wanted to say real quick.
I apologize to our callers that with five men with a lot to say, we didn't get to all of you waiting online to get in here, but we're almost out of time. Jerry,
okay, I just want to say real quickly in that same vein, I currently have an exhibit of at the New Beginnings Barbershop Gallery. I don't know if anyone here knows about it.
Troy State.
And Troy is an excellent example of how to bring art to the community.
Yeah.
The whole concept of the shop, it's a community.
It's a gallery that poses as a barbershop.
And Jerry, tell everybody where New Beginnings is, because you know that's directly reaching the population that I was discussing and we are concerned about.
Exactly. It's at 1407 Holland Street at the corner of Arlington Avenue, right across from the Holland Street Market. And I'd like people to go there and just kind of get a sense of what I'm talking about. And you talk about bringing art to the community. How do we start? How do we start ascertaining power in our community through the arts? And a lot of good points were here. Coley made some great points about masculinity, and so did Keith.
So we are out of time. And I want to apologize for our listeners. We did not get your calls, Shelhi, Afrikaan, others. We didn't get your calls. I apologize for that. Next time I will control this better and get into your calls. maybe make it a longer conversation or fewer men. I don't know. We'll figure out which one it is. But I want to thank all of them for being here. Coley Tengela, Keith Snipes, Jerry Prettyman, Bashi Rose, David Ross. Good to have you all in the studio.
Thank you.
Good to be here, Mark.
We'll come back in a couple of weeks with another episode of Deep Voices. Stay with us.